Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. And this, yet another salute to our Canadian friends. We call this the Wall Just Got 10 Feet Taller Show. Here's the thing, Rick.
Why couldn't we have called it the Taller Waller Show?
Because Donald Trump is so darn quotable. You have to admit, wouldn't you like to have a quote of the day from Donald Trump?
I got some good news, Tony.
What's that?
You're going to get 4 years worth of quotes
from Donald Trump. But at any rate, we magnanimously reached out to those poor radio refugees from Canada and allowed them to cross our hypothetical electronic Facebook border. And what do they do? And admittedly, we've asked them to do this, but they start commenting. They start liking things. They basically do all the things that we ask U.S. citizens to do to our Facebook page, and it's getting darn annoying. And so it was time, I think, for us to recalibrate, don't you think?
You're going
to
do that?
I am not.
You are the keeper of said wall.
I am not a racist, but.
No, wait a minute.
Those famous last words. I'm not a racist, but
with any, I'm convinced when the conjunction is what got you
right. The wall just got 10 feet taller. But we do welcome our Canadian friends and our listeners.
Rather than build a wall, why don't we just drive them away?
We'll be obnoxious enough. Which we're very good at. This should not be a problem.
Considerably easier to do.
With the keys to our web presence from the University of Kentucky to explain these to you, the manager of communications infrastructure, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. It's a good thing there's not a 10-foot wall between the two of us, right?
It's getting taller.
Yeah, it's not that tall. So, audio shows, WMKY.org. What is that? That's Moorhead State Public Radio's website. Yes, there's more than just Health Matters on that site. And yes, you will have to do just a little bit of searching. You know, and if you end up on one of the other shows, like we say, you know, show the radio station a little love, listen to some of those other good shows, but then find your way over to Health Matters. Look at the list of shows. It'll be the more recent shows. You don't have to worry about listening to that 13-year-old dead weight that, you know, we've still got nagging out there on the internet somewhere. Listen to the new ones. Sign up for the podcast. If you know what to podcast, then you know what a podcast is, then you know what to do. If you don't, jump over on Wikipedia or something and read about it. It's a cool way to have Health Matters delivered to you automatically as soon as it goes up live on the web. So certainly do that. After you've listened to the show, there's a thing called Facebook. Yeah, it's for the over 30s now. I get it. It's most of us. The young folks have kind of left Facebook behind, or at least parts of it. Jump over to Facebook, facebook.com/HMRadioShow. You'll find a fan page. That's your opportunity to like us, to interact with us, to ask us questions, give us feedback, comments. You'll find interesting things there. I think we post things from time to time. Some things are curious. Some things are crazy. Some things are relevant. All kinds of things there. And it's your opportunity to get in some show topics. Pretty much anything you want.
Pretty much. And please, some real American comments. And let's
if you can get over the wall. We enjoy interacting with
your comments, regardless of where you come from.
Facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for today's show, the PCS K9 inhibitors. You may remember these are the potent, newly approved cholesterol drugs.
Does this keep the dogs away?
For people, I get it. I get it. It was not funny, but I got it.
Well, but K9 inhibitors, that sounds like
a new format for this particular sponsor.
Is it where I be quiet?
This is going to be a question and answer session, and Rick is going to spontaneously pepper me with three or four questions.
Well, I was hoping it was insults.
which I'm going to answer strictly out of my vast knowledge of PCS K9 inhibitors. So, Rick, what would be the first question that you would have, for instance, from an expert on PCS K9 inhibitors?
Can I do this from a non-expert? Because, frankly, I'm not an expert.
Okay, so just read the question.
Maybe we could
read the spontaneous question.
Maybe
now.
We could say, Tony, what are PCS K9 inhibitors?
All right, this is a new class of lipid lowering medicines.
Now, you act like you're reading from something. Tell me the answer.
They are monthly or two monthly subcutaneous injections. That is, you inject them under your skin. They are antibodies to PCSK9, which is a protein. Now, the PCSK9 protein lays into your bad cholesterol receptor and blocks it. So we figure, well, why don't we block the blocker. If we can block the PCSK9, you will have more bad cholesterol receptors. You'll be able to pull more bad cholesterol out of your bloodstream. So that's what they are. All right, do you have any other spontaneous questions
you'd like
to read to me?
How do they work?
I just told you. I got ahead of myself. They block.
I'm going to make you say it again because you've got a script.
I know. I really blew this one.
It's not my fault if you're not following the script.
I blew this one. They just in case, for the hard of hearing, we'll go over it again. PCSK9, a binding protein, lays in the receptor for bad cholesterol, keeps it from breaking down bad cholesterol. You block the blocker, and that receptor is open and able to degrade the cholesterol. What else do you want to know?
Which PCSK9 inhibitors are approved for use in the U.S.?
I am glad you asked that question.
I am glad you wrote it for
me. Praluent was approved by the FDA July 24th in 2015, and Repatha was approved August 27th of 2015. So there are two on the market right now.
Why couldn't I just say Repatha? Why do I got to say PCSK9 inhibitors?
If you want to say Repatha for PCSK9, you can do
that. What are the FDA-approved indications for PCSK9 inhibitors?
See, you can say it.
Of course I can say it. I'm a relatively, you know...
Well, I thought you wanted to say Repatha. I was ready for a Repatha question, and now you went PCSK9 in it.
Do you want me to insult you or not?
Current FDA-approved indications. And this is important. Again, they say an adjunct to diet and maximally tolerated statins if you have something called heterozygous familial hypercholesterolemia. That is a familial, a runs in families type of high cholesterol, or you have heart disease and require additional lowering. So you start by going to the maximum tolerated doses of statins, and then these are add-ons. They're really add-ons more than any other reason because they are so terrifically expensive, and you have to inject them under your skin rather than take it by mouth.
Did you say terrifically expensive?
Yeah.
Are you a stock owner in the company?
No, I am not. I don't know if I've got the cost of it or not, but the problem is you have to take them all your life. Yeah, I've got the cost. We'll get to that probably in our
third
fractional
portion. That's one of the others. Okay.
Yeah,
so here's the last question for this fractional portion.
Fair enough.
How effective are they at lowering your LDL-C?
Now, you know they would not be a sponsor if they weren't very effective.
No, wait a minute. We put ineffective sponsors on all the time. And you know it.
Got me on that one. Agreed. But in a couple of trials, again, they had about a 50% reduction in the bad cholesterol levels even after you were on statins. So you do your best with statins, and you'll still be able to drop your cholesterol level by around 50% compared with the statins. So they are remarkably effective at lowering cholesterol. But again, the expense, the difficulty of injection is going to be a problem with these drugs.
So now, Tony, we went through all this trouble of this script, and there is a cool phrase in the question number 5, and you wouldn't even say it. What was the name of the trial that they came up with a 50% reduction?
You're looking at the Odyssey Combo 2?
Yeah, wouldn't you like to be a part of the Odyssey Combo 2 trial?
It sounds like almost like a space.
Yeah, it's cool, man. Yeah, I mean, there's a transporter involved in this.
Yeah, here we are on board the Odyssey Combo 2.
Interestingly enough.
Testing the PCSK9
2001 pad. A Space Odyssey was 15 years ago. Think about that. Just chew on that for your fractional portion.
That's our sponsor, the PCSK9 inhibitors. And we'll have more spontaneous questions from Rick. In our second fractional portion,
we start,
and Rick, this is going to keep you enthralled and engaged at least for 30 seconds. Undercover officers arrested Dennis Nickel, who's a financial analyst at the Chicago-based University of Illinois Hospital and Health Sciences System. So this was, in fact, a financial analyst at a hospital and health sciences system. He used an illegal device to jam passenger cell phone calls on public trains in Chicago.
Nice. That's against the rules.
It is.
It's against, and you know, it's against federal law, not state law.
He's a 63-year-old CPA, there were photos online for months of him with this device he's got. This is how it went down, okay? I'm going to tell you how it went down.
It went out, technically.
It went down.
It went out.
An undercover mission team went into action when they saw him enter the Loyola Station on the red line. That's important. He was not on the yellow or green line. It was the red line.
You get more trouble if you're on the red line?
Let's face it. Everybody rides on the red
line. Well, but you're wanting to be specific about the
right
line.
One of the officer sat near him and started a call on his cell phone. Mr. Nickel removed a black box, we would call it.
So now we're red line, black box.
Right. With multiple antennas from his pocket, he pushed a button and the officer lost his cell phone signal.
Maybe they went through a tunnel.
Gone.
Maybe they went through a tunnel.
Not so. Holding the jamming device in his hand, he was arrested at the next train stop, charged with unlawful interference with a public utility. That is a felony, as Rick mentioned. And several people had The reason...
You know why, right? You know why, right?
Why it's a felony?
Right. Why you can't do that.
All right. Tell me why you can't do that.
911.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
You're not allowed to impede public safety. And there are public safety frequencies that happen on that cellular system that you are not allowed to mess with. And so you jam one signal, you jam them all, you're going to prevent everybody in that region from being able to dial 911.
Gotcha. So he told...
Aren't you glad you invited me to the show?
Yeah, I'm learning stuff. According to the arrest report, he said he gets annoyed at people talking on their cell phones while riding on the Chicago Transit Authority. So he... basically blocks them with his black box with antennas.
Right. And that's really just a cruel thing to do because it really doesn't help him because he can't make a call either.
According to his lawyer, he might have been selfish in thinking about himself. I think most people who think about themselves are selfish.
Well, that's generally the definition by Webster's.
Selfish, I believe so. Right. I always wondered if Bill Self's Kansas basketball teams play selfish basketball.
Interesting thing. Well, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, they certainly don't play selfless.
Yeah, because unless it gets technical.
Well, they play self more, not less.
Yeah, maybe so. He might have been selfish thinking about himself, but he didn't have any malicious intent. Yet, as Rick pointed out, this could have had some serious problems.
Absolutely. Yeah. And who knows what the range was on that jammer. So maybe people two or three train cars back could not call 911.
Yeah, but he's a pretty serious jammer. His jamming equipment was confiscated and destroyed in 2009, but apparently he bought some more. This is a serious, I don't like cell phones guy.
Well, yeah, but the thing is what I don't understand is most people don't like the cell phone because of the radiated energy or the potential risk for, you know, possibly some kind of cancerous, breakdown of the cells or something like that. Fact is, you use a jammer, guess what you're doing? You're transmitting RF.
Yeah, and the other thing is...
You're actually putting more RF in the system.
If I had a jammer, I wouldn't pull it out of my pocket. I would reach my hand down.
You don't
my
want
pocket.
That thing close to your. Yeah, you don't want that in your pocket.
Okay, well, I put it in my backpack and I'd reach in and push a button. I'm not going to pull it out because then everybody sees me with something with a bunch of antennas.
Boy, I hope this people didn't just totally drop in onto this show late because we're talking about a subway, Tony.
We should move on.
A jammer.
All right. We got.
No, you can't go to the next topic. You got to talk about this guy, how bad this is. You cannot.
Okay. All right. So I thought I might get your interest about this. So what happens?
No. And this is the same thing. This is the exact same reason why they don't like you using like a radar jammer. They don't want you to interfere with public safety frequencies, and there's no guarantee that you can't interfere with them. Now, obviously, if you're not jamming on that frequency, you shouldn't. Jamming a radar detector shouldn't, be the same. But the thing is, they just don't want you doing it because there's so many unknown circumstances, potential circumstances. So, I mean, it's bad. And, would I like to be able to shut down some people talking, the guy walking through, they're sitting next to you at the restaurant that's talking loud on his phone while you're trying to eat a meal? It's like, come on, dude, really? I'd love to jam your signal and shut you down, but it's against the law. You can't do it.
Hold that thought, because you just reminded me of an article I had planned to not even talk about this show. But it's going to be important. It's going to be very important, and we're going to wait till after the break to tell you about it. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio. Please stay tuned.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Wall Just Got 10 Feet Taller show.
And you're not being jammed show.
That's true. Yeah.
We hope. Well, if you're hearing us, you're clearly.
Right. More on jamming after our sponsor. And our sponsor.
Do we really have to talk about our sponsor? Really?
Yes.
Can we just like once in like 13 years just skip it? It's about drugs.
They pay the bills.
No, they don't.
I know.
We don't have any bills. We got Tony's and we got Rick.
We're not really supposed to do a financial statement
Paul
on public.
And a Dan.
Yeah, no bills. I get it.
We could Chuck Mraz.
That one's come up before. All right, so here's our 10 questions about PCSK9. Rick has spontaneously come up with the 10 questions. Last time, you remember, these are the PCSK9 inhibitors are antibodies that block the PCSK9, which... It actually blocks itself. It blocks the receptor that breaks down your bad cholesterol. So if we block the blockers, then that receptor is wide open and it clears out bad cholesterol more rapidly. There are two of them. One is alirocumab, which is Praluent. The other one is evolocumab, which was Repatha. Both those approved in 2015. The indications after maximally tolerated statin therapy, if you either have a familial elevation of your cholesterol or you have significant cardiovascular disease and need additional lowering, that's where they are approved by the FDA. They will, on top of statins, even after you go to your maximum dose of statins, they will still lower your cholesterol an additional 50%. They're extremely powerful. Now, Rick, while I've been talking, have you thought of some other questions that you would want to know about PCSK9 inhibitors?
Well, we're going to get back to our scripted reality show. So, yeah, I've got a couple here, Tony.
Okay.
Maybe even as many as five.
I just go with two. You know, I don't want to overdo this.
Are PCSK9 inhibitors indicated for patients with
station intolerance.
Yeah, well, you put indicated and statin.
No, Health Matters is indicated if you have station intolerance.
All right. We're gonna start this over, and we may or may not edit this thing out.
Okay.
Are PCSK9 inhibitors indicated for patients with statin intolerance?
That's right, statin intolerance. Now, what the FDA said is maximally tolerated therapy. That's not the same as statin intolerant. So the determination of inability to tolerate statin therapy, there's really a pretty complicated issue. Whether or not there may be a different brand or a different alternative, a different dose and so forth. So the FDA actually avoided statin intolerant because of concerns that we may abandon statins prematurely. And statins have been shown to be very good drugs. The statins, by the way, this is Crestor, Lipitor, Zocor, and Pravacol, medicines like that. Those have been shown through the years to be very effective at lowering your risk of heart disease. We would like to make sure that we don't bypass them just because we have a very new and very expensive medicine.
So if PCSK9 inhibitors been shown to lower the risk for MI or cardiovascular death?
Now, that's an important question. It really is.
Aren't you glad I asked that question?
Yeah, I really am, and I'm glad that you're reading the...
I didn't read that. I made that up. There's no script
but
in front of me.
Here's the thing. I mean, they bring the cholesterol down. Now, we had Dr. Wayne on this show, a cardiologist at the University of Kentucky, who said that he felt there was abundant evidence that you could say anything that lowers the cholesterol and doesn't have terrific side effects would be beneficial. That is, the lower the cholesterol by any method, the lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. However, these drugs have not been shown to lower your risk of heart attack, to lower your risk of cardiovascular death or other outcomes. They've only been shown to affect your laboratory tests. So there is a leap of faith that you have to take to say, okay, I think that there's enough evidence that lowering that would be good.
I got another important question.
All right.
Are there any safety concerns or side effects?
All right, here we go. Very few worrisome side effects. It does cause thinning of the wallet because it's a very expensive drug. Other than that, no excess of emergency events. They did have a little bit fewer muscle-related events than they did have with Zetia when they compared it side to side. Injection site reactions. I mean, basically, you're giving this under the skin. Your skin's going to get irritated. I had some... nasal pharyngitis, actually irritation of the sinuses, I guess you would call it, more common. And the other thing that they just mentioned, the articles mentioned, and this is very frustrating and vague, concerns have been raised about the potential for cognitive side effects. That is, it may make you a little bit more confused, but they're doing some long-term monitoring on that. So far, it has not been borne out by the short-term monitoring, but there are some concerns. So, yeah, I mean, these are new drugs. I think we're still learning the side effects. Nothing so far looks harmful. But there are some questions raised. That is our sponsor, the PCSK9 inhibitors. Rick and I having a spontaneous discussion about the kind of questions people ask about these drugs. Now, we mentioned last time, and this was about the only thing we mentioned last time, there was a CPA that was affiliated with a Chicago area healthcare system who pulled out a black box and shut down the phone system on the Chicago Transit Authority. He was arrested. That is a felony for reasons that Rick explained. And Rick was talking about jamming devices in general. Interfering with things, and it just reminded me, I had this stowed back, wasn't going to bring it on the show, but I think it's important. This was April 4th, 2016. The FDA announced it's received a small number of adverse events reports related to CAT scanning and implantable or wearable electronic devices, and they're talking about insulin pumps. You attach it to your belt. It actually pumps insulin in under your skin. There is a tube that connects to a needle that's placed under the skin. again for that. So it interferes with that. Also, and this is scary, cardiac implantable devices and also nerve stimulation devices as well. So it does not appear that they cause enough problems that if you had a defibrillator implanted or you were using an insulin pump that you shouldn't have the scan, but they wanted people to be aware of it, doctors to be aware of it, and so forth. If something happened, you'd have to think about it. But these apparently are very rare and not likely to cause a problem. On the other hand, if you're sitting next to a guy with a defibrillator or a pacemaker or an insulin pump, again, we did not expect the CT scan would have anything to do with this. And you pull out some kind of jamming device.
Yeah, some kind of high power RF emitting jamming device.
Then you could very well jam a medical implant.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the thing is there are harmonics that happen. So for instance, Tony, all you techies out there, don't hold me to this because this is not, I'm making this for example purposes, not for actual accuracy. So say you had a 1 megahertz signal, right? Sometimes that gives off a 25 megahertz, you know, kind of side band, you know, so it's not just because you're jamming on one frequency. If you're doing it at extremely high power, there are harmonics that happen that can affect other bands.
So here's what happens. You know, Rick's flying a drone over my house, which I hate. So I go out and I'm going to jam the drone.
You got a beautiful pond, by the way.
And bring it down. And then the next thing I know, I've jammed the neighbor's pacemaker and the neighbor's sitting there gasping for breath. And meanwhile, the drone flies off.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, we are becoming more electronically dependent anyway.
Well, and let's be honest, there was a time where we were tethered to our house by a pair of wires, right? A pair of copper cables. And then we got into the internet, which still got us through those copper cables, right? For the most part.
Right.
And then sometimes it went to your TV cable and us. But as we move farther and farther into the future, everything's going mobile and cellular, which is all RF based, right? Different bands of RF.
And it all could be shut down.
You could be sent to the dark ages with one jamming device.
That's a little scary.
I mean, you know, and you're talking about automatically driving cars. You're talking about, you know, kitchens that cook automatically that, you know, whether they may or may not turn off.
You are not making me comfortable.
No, well, I'm just saying, you think about the dependence that we're getting on the network, and the network has become invisible, right? So we have to protect, by some measure, we have to protect our airwaves because we will, before long, become very, very dependent on publicly accessible airwaves.
And while I've got Rick engaged, and obviously I do have him engaged, he's asking
talking about drugs.
Intelligent questions about PCSK9 inhibitors. He's giving, I think, expert opinions about how vulnerable we are and so forth. Rick, you'll love this one. This was published in Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise. I believe this was in April. It was in their April issue. And this is what they did. They had 40 adults, half of them men. They wore 9 devices to track every aspect of their life for 24 hours.
So they were like, I think the term they use in UK healthcare, I've heard them use the term a gunslinger. You know, they have the bandolier across them with all the different things on it.
They actually had a kit. They had a utility belt, a Batman-style utility belt.
Right.
Plus, they had sweatbands and things like that so they could transfer these things for different things. And what they were asking, I'll read you, first of all, for those of you who want to move on and get to a really decent radio show, I'll just give you the real quick. They had 9 devices, including the Fitbit, the Gene Active, Jawbone Up, LumoBack, and the Nike Fuel Band. Those were the ones that they were actually testing. They had something called the Z Machine, which was, it has electrodes that attach to your scalp and measures your sleep, an Omron pedometer, an ActivPal, an Actigraph GT3X Plus, all these devices strapped on at the same time to see how accurate they were. And again, the bottom line on this, the error rates range from 8 to 17% for sleeping, from 9 to 67% for sedentary behavior, from 20% to 28% for light physical activity, 51 to 92% error rates for moderate to vigorous activity, and 14 to 30% for steps taken. So the point is, you know, we've got all these monitoring devices, and really, 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 how good are these monitoring devices? I just had a a patient mentioned to me that she was walking, she was carrying, I think, boxes or something like that, and she was walking long distances, but her device would not pick it up because she wasn't swinging her arm.
Nice.
And so she said she didn't get any credit at all for all those steps. And this, you know, this might
sound... what the beauty of that is? You do get credit for those steps. Your body gives you credit. Now, you may not have it on a piece of paper, but you did walk.
And so, Mr. Wonderful, Mr. Knows the World, here's the problem. You know yourself. Employee health programs now will bonus you back based on the number of steps you take. So, in fact, yes, there is that ephemeral health benefit, but if we're talking about dollars and cents, this woman just got cheated out
got
of possibly... just saying.
Tony, you want me to increase your steps? I'll sell you that app.
Now, so this is the short of it, but the long of it's kind of interesting, Rick. We have all these things now that track different things. The problem is we've not put them together into how you should spend your day. Now, in general, we say, all right, well, you need to get 7.5 to 8 hours of sleep.
Is that what you get?
Yeah.
I'm a few hours short.
I know. You should get half an hour of vigorous exercise a day. You should get 8 hours or so of light activity a day. That leaves 8 hours left you probably would be okay to do sedentary behavior of some sort. But the thing is, what if, say, if you're a poor sleeper, you eat too much, and you don't physically exercise, what would give you the most bang for your buck? Where do you need to start to try to improve your lifestyle? You see, so we don't really, these are all different groups. Sleep labs work on sleep. Cardiologists work on exercise. So there's really not anyone that's looking at how you should spend your day. I think that's pretty interesting.
Well, but I think, you know, knowing how you spend your day is going to be so vastly different between people that they're going to have to come up with, you know, basic general categories and kind of identify, you know, it's really going to end up being sedentary versus active versus eating
right.
X versus, you know, I mean, in the end, aren't 2-7 billion people going to look real similar? I mean, at least...
Maybe, but I think we ought to be able to give them advice on their day, not just on, you know, one aspect. Like, okay, you need to go 10,000 steps. Okay, should I go 10,000 steps by running for a half an hour? Should I go 10,000 steps by light activity? How should I do that?
I don't know, Tony. You know, the thing is we're getting really good at the wearable technology that will allow you to determine how many steps, how many miles, the GPS course you ran, the heart rate you went up to while you were running. We've got all this data on calories burned and all that. You know what they still can't seem to perfect? What I'm putting in. They can't figure out how to scan the apple or scan the bowl of spaghetti or the hamburger. They rely on you to describe what you ate and then put it in. At some point, somebody is going to figure out how to take a picture of what you're getting ready to eat, and that picture will then correlate that into some kind of calorie count, some kind of configuration.
All right, Mr. Technology, you still got your watch on?
Of course.
Yes, you got your watch there. Now, how does that watch measure your sleep? How do you get the watch to measure
your
sleep?
At night, I tell it I am about to go down
Rick
to sleep.
Rick pushes a button that says, I'm going to sleep.
No, that's not, that is what I do because it is the way you're supposed to do it. In the event my arm lays completely still for 2 hours, it will detect sleep based on the heart rate and inactivity. But it happens after it's been motionless for 2 hours. So there, if I forget to push that little button and I wake up the next morning, it takes about an hour or two, but it'll sync up and finally say, oh, we detected that you slept between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m.
So participants
were... And it's surprisingly accurate.
Surprisingly accurate, he says. But now the question, it also, it judges the quality of your sleep.
Of course. It tells you how many times you woke up.
Yeah, the amount of, and that's by motion.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. It's motion, it's by heart rate, it's by,
right.
You know.
And
I don't think it's by UV light because I don't sleep outside.
Right. And according to this, the rates were actually not bad, 8% to 17% for that sleep. And that what they did was they monitored brainwave tracings, and then they went back and looked at these type of devices and said, okay, if you push the button or if it detects lack of motion and assumes sleep, 8 to 16%, not bad. But, you know, question is, participants asked to wear all 9 devices for one day, one full day of activity, one full night of sleep.
That ought to be worth some exercise right there.
Could you go to bed with 9 9 devices on you.
I can't go to bed with like 2 devices. I mean, he's calling it a watch, but the wearable, it certainly is noticeable. And it took a little bit to get used to it because, you know, I usually don't.
Right.
But yeah, I can't imagine. That'd be like taking an EEG or not an EEG, but a sleep study where you got to sleep with all the leads on you. Now, that would have to be difficult.
Sedentary behaviors. One, detected your posture. Most of these devices have an accelerometer. And again, if you don't move your arm, you're sedentary. Error rates on that 10% to 66%. So not very good at detecting being sedentary.
Well, I mean, what happens is you have micro movements, right? I mean,
right.
So, you know, when you're sleeping, you know, you're not laying completely still. You might move a few inches.
Now, we did the best we could at monitoring light physical activity, including diaries and a research level device. 20% to 28% for light physical activity. They'd be walking about the house and so forth. They could figure that out. If you got to moderately vigorous physical activity, you should be able to track the heart rate or something with that. But in fact, the error rates on that were 50 to 90%. That is, these machines are not good at figuring out that you're vigorously physically active.
Right.
And I guess, you know, if the GPS, if your GPS is moving rapidly down the path, that's one thing. But I guess if you're standing in place or lifting something or doing that sort of stuff, it doesn't pick that up well.
Well, I mean,
it seems like it should be able to from your heart rate.
Well, yeah, but if it's using heart rate as a way to determine vigorous, then, you know, 8 seconds into my first racquetball game, I'm vigorous.
You're vigorous.
But that's not true.
Okay.
Trust me, I'm not.
Okay.
I, you know.
And then 14% to 30% for steps. And again, depending on how the device captures the steps, you can get cheated with that. It's something to think about. I mean, if,
why don't
again,
you
if
have
you're
a wearable,
you know,
you don't want to know, do you?
No, Robert Wachter, who is a hospitalist, he was the guy that coined the term hospitalist. He is a guy that started the practice of doctors practicing entirely in the hospital. He said, in my ICU patients, I don't have nearly that much information, and I still don't know what to do with it.
Neil, so how does this relate to wearables?
I'm just saying, it floods you with information that you don't know what to do with. What if...
Well, you could share it with the world over this radio show.
Well, we've talked about 10,000 steps. Is 10,000 the right threshold? Maybe it's 12,000. Maybe it's 8,000.
Better than 9,000.
It's probably better than 9,000, but you don't know that. It may be that once you get to 8,000, everything else is gravy.
Doesn't feel like it.
You think that 10,000 is better than
8,000? Well, I mean, after 10 or 12, or I mean, back when we were redoing the Commonwealth Stadium, we walked, you know, for me, I was walking 14 and 15,000 steps a day, which is an enormous amount for me when I'm a, you know, My average is somewhere in the, you know, 4,000 to 6,000 per day range on a good day. So, you know, you start double and triple in that, you've done something. So, yeah, you know, it certainly does help you to know whether you're a slug or not.
Right.
Plus, it's nagging. It nags you. It whines. It says, get up. Go get
But it doesn't. But that's the question. It's not evidence-based. The stuff that it tells you to do, you're not sure if that's the best thing to do. Example. This is back to the paper. At present, the most common activity intervention is to increase daily exercise. Right?
Sure.
But for those who are sleeping less than 6 hours a night, increasing exercise may prove to be less important than increasing sleep. So we really need to have...
We should walk to the pharmacy and get some sleeping pills.
We start with accurate measurements, and then we can maybe make some recommendations based on those accurate measurements. Without that, we're just guessing. And more, more, more is not really a very good plan
I have a theory.
Get you physically fit.
I have a theory. Unfortunately, we have to get off the air, so that theory is going to go unrealized.
I'm so sorry. I'm going to interrupt your theory. We got to get off the air, Rick.
You'll hear it later.
Taking a break. We'll be back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
You sounded hesitant on that. Are you sure?
Well, I was trying to get over the wall.
Okay, gotcha. I'm Dr.
That wall keeps getting a lot taller and taller.
This is The Wall Just Got 10 Feet Taller. Show our salute to our Canadian infiltrators for our Facebook page. Thank you very much for asking questions. Why don't Americans, real Americans, do the same thing as these Canadian infiltrators? We don't know, but we do appreciate the chatter on our Facebook page. Our sponsor for the final time, the PCSK9 inhibitors, inhibiting cholesterol somewhere near you. Now, let's go over what we know about them. This is an antibody that blocks PCSK9. PCSK9. PCSK9, in turn, blocks the channels that clear cholesterol, bad cholesterol out of your system. So if we block the blocker, those channels stay open. They clear more bad cholesterol. They clear more LDL cholesterol and lower your LDL or bad cholesterol levels. They were approved, two of them. There's Praluent and Repatha are the brand names. They are approved by the FDA as an adjunct to diet and maximally tolerated statins. Not intolerant of statins, because that's really hard to determine, but maximally tolerated statins and diet if you have a familial high cholesterol or if you have significant heart disease and a cholesterol that needs to be lowered further. How effective? Even on maximum statin therapy, they can still drop your cholesterol an additional 50%, according to the famous Odyssey Combo 2 trial. And I had the Odyssey Combo 2 with fries, and I thought it was pretty good, a good value for your money.
Well, yeah, you should have went with the Odyssey Dollar Menu. Mm-hmm.
The PCSK9 inhibitors are not indicated for statin intolerance, although I think they will wind up being used for that. They have not been shown to affect your risk of heart attack or dying. This is a key thing. They've been shown to lower the laboratory cholesterol levels. Some people think that's enough. Other people say, no, these drugs should be tested to see if they actually make you live longer, because you're going to be taking them a long time. Safety concerns or side effects, not very much. They're watching for any changes in cognition. The biggest events, pain at the injection site, because you give it as a shot under your skin, some muscle-related pain, and irritation of the nose and sinuses. Now, Rick, after I've said all this, I know you must have some additional questions.
Only a couple.
Okay.
How much do they cost?
$13,000 a year.
Is that all? My gosh, we could do three or four.
Well, lifetime use, $13,000 a year.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it really
is. I mean, that's, you know, what, $1,100 a month, right?
Right.
I mean, it's $1,150, $1,200 a
month. And you can get a statin drug now for $4 a month. So you essentially go from $48 to $13,000 when you add these on to a generic statin at $4 a month. That is, that's a significant change, I think, no doubt about it. Anything else, Rick?
Well, what is the summary?
It sounds like Dan Rather.
Can you please summarize
What's the
that?
Summary? They're a new class of very powerful cholesterol-lowering drugs. They offer treatment to a group of people who have either a genetic high cholesterol or they are at very high risk for heart disease. Ongoing trials, according to this article, and post-marketing data will provide more information. They're a bit of an unknown. Well, one thing we do know is they can knock your cholesterol down like nobody's business. That's the PCSK9 inhibitors, lowering cholesterol in a patient near you. Now, we talked about the, I think we pretty well wrapped up, Rick. You had a theory. We interrupted your theory, so go.
Didn't. The clock did. I mean, we have these
but
kind of banjo breaks we have to stop and take. But no, I think, you know, the thing about wearables is while you and I may have seen these on the market, and I've been going to CES in Las Vegas and, you know, in January, and they've obviously become more and more prevalent. They've been around for 3 or 4 years, but probably been real popular for 2 to maybe 3 years. All we're doing right now is putting them on people's wrists, and now we're just now getting to the part where the data is going into a website. Or it's going into some repository where it could be extracted and be part of some bigger data sets, right? So maybe the data doesn't help you, Tony Weaver, looking at your watch. Maybe you have a hard time assessing it for its, you know, some valuable information. And maybe, you know, the work group you are at work that puts 10 people together and walks and does their activity, maybe even all the members of a small health insurance group is not enough. But let's put a billion people on one of these. Let's grab a billion people's data. Then you can start filtering and doing big data analysis, which is what the world is really starting to do, is you're starting to see these huge big data movements. When you've got massive amounts of data, you can get really granular and you can find those needles and in some cases see trends and see things that you just can't see when you're right up. It's literally used to, remember the saying, you can't see the forest for the trees?
Right.
Now we can.
Now, what are we talking about? For instance, if there was suddenly a jump in pulse rate in people in Japan, there may very well be an earthquake.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
Is worth looking at. And they've looked at, forget the pulse rate, the fact that there's a bunch of bands that suddenly start moving, the accelerometers start moving in those bands, that's enough to possibly indicate an
earthquake. That's a really fast trending thing. But what about, okay, all of a sudden we see a popularity of barbecue places across the South. You know, I mean, that's a bad example, but, you know, maybe some new thing, some new, you know, one of these big fast food chains releases something that becomes, like, for instance, maybe a low carb diet becomes very popular and lots of people jump on these low carb diets. And all of a sudden we see calorie intakes changing, or we see, I mean, you just never know.
And then we can use it to track information that we just don't have. How often do people develop irregular heartbeats and not know about it?
Right.
That data comes in. What these are types of questions.
How does that correlate to the current trends in the, right. in the food that's being prepared or being delivered?
So, one, we really have to integrate the 24-hour data to try to figure out if sleep is more important than exercise, if exercise is more important than steps, if steps is more important than avoiding sedentary behaviors. These are the kind of things that we really need to know. Secondly, as Rick mentions, we pull together huge amounts of data from huge numbers of people. And by the way, the companies are collecting it.
Of course.
They do
well,
it.
If you give it to them. 2 years ago, you couldn't take your Fitbit information and get it into a website. You know, so they're just now starting to come up with these incentive programs. For instance, at UK, I don't think there's any danger in me talking about this. UK employees have the access to extremely reduced price Fitbits, right? So, for instance, the Charge HR, which is one of the nicest Fitbits on the market from the company Fitbit. It's like $149, you know, if you go out and buy it, but through this special health program, you can get it for under $70, you know, $75 with shipping, something like that. And so they're really encouraging people to buy these. And so now you're seeing them going to more people, but to do that, you got to be part of like a walking group or a challenge group, I think they call them. And so everybody tries to get the most steps per day, right? Which team wins and okay, you think great. Okay. So these teams are competing for the number of steps. But what's that doing? It's taking big groups of people at UK and getting them out and getting them active, thus lowering, you know, increasing the possibility that their health increases, right?
Yeah.
And thus lowering some of their time off work, insurance premiums. I mean, there's probably a whole host of things that come with being more healthy. But the side benefit is you got tons of data now being captured that have to be moved into these systems external to the person, right? So no longer is that just on my computer, or no longer is it just on my watch. It's actually going somewhere and somebody else has access to the data. That's when the big data starts.
So there's no doubt there's a future in wearables. The stuff that we've got now is pretty primitive. It will get better. And as Rick mentions, as we aggregate data, we will learn a lot more about the reactions.
So Tony, just as we're leaving, that's think about.
Hopefully, I'm pleased that you like it.
Sorry
so much.
Though, you know, you bring these tech stuff on here and you quit talking about drugs, and of course, you know.
Yeah.
So think about Google. Right? Search engines. Did we ever think the very first time you did a search on Google, you probably went, wow, this is cool. But you never thought, you know, someday they're going to look at the searches across the U.S. and find out how flu and virus are tracking and trending across the U.S. Where are people searching for measles?
Yeah.
We never thought they were going to do that, but they do. And so I think you're going to see the wearable data is in its infancy.
The interconnectedness is going to
a term they throw out there is called the Internet of Things, right? And that what that really means is devices are going to be meshed together. They're going to be big common data sets.
Next up, something much simpler than that, Kentucky highway fatalities.
And we were talking about good stuff, and now you go there.
Well, we got to.
Is it good? Are they up or
no,
they down?
No, they're up, and so it's not good. Our overall accident and injury rate is rising, and that includes drug overdoses and other accidents, but specifically motor vehicle crashes on Kentucky's highways. Now, I'm going to go back to 2008, give you some idea of where we started. 2008, we dropped to 826. We had been up around 1,000. We were dropping steadily. We dropped to 826. We dropped to 791 in 2009, but our gas price went down by about a dollar, and yet we still dropped to 791. That's pretty impressive, you got to admit. When the gas price drops, people drive more miles.
Right.
And if you drop the gas price by a dollar, you got more miles driven, and yet your fatality rate between 2008 and 2009 dropped. I don't know why, particularly. Then it dropped to 760 in 2010, 720 in 2011, assuming safety features, airbags, those type of things were happening. There was a period from 2011 to 2014 when the gas prices pretty much remained flat. 2011, we had 720 deaths. 2012, 746. 2013, The first year after House Bill 1, our narcotics bill went into effect, we dropped down to 638. We went from 746 to 638, the largest single year drop since I've been watching these things, basically since around 2005. I've tried to keep track of those. I don't have the numbers of 2005 now, but that was it had been going down by 20, by 20, by 20. It dropped by 100 from 746 to 738, 2012 to 2013, and gas prices stayed flat. So this was not about fewer miles driven. It was just simply a big drop. Maybe House Bill 1, maybe we got some narcotics users off the road. I don't know. The next year, we're up to 665, same gas price. Then in 2015, the last year recorded, gas prices dropped down to $2.30 average for the year, and our number shot up to 745. So we're back basically where we were in 2010 on our auto fatalities. That is despite the fact that we have alcohol-related fatalities. There's no doubt about it. We don't have as many as the states around us, but we do have alcohol-related fatalities. I thought maybe we could reduce our narcotic drug-related fatalities, our pain pill-related fatalities, but if we did, it was only temporary and came back. And now we're worse off than we've been in the past 5 years on car crashes.
So these things report these numbers, but do they give us any inclination as to what they might think is going on?
So I mapped it with gas prices to try to figure that out. And again, we are no doubt driving more miles. Our gas price, average gas price, dropped from $3.60 per gallon to $2.30 per gallon between 2014 and 2015. Our number of deaths went up by 90.
Do you think that
or 80, sorry.
The gas price dropping, do you really think that it directly impacts the miles driven? I mean, I think you're right. I think it does. But I also think that every year that I've been on the face of the earth, it seems to me like humans tend, the average miles per year goes up for human driving. It seems like we do more, we go more, we are more. There's just something about it that I wonder when that will plateau.
Well, you know,
I'd be curious to see what the average miles.
Well, you know, when we got up close to $5 a gallon, you know, when we were up in the $4 a gallon range.
Don't you think that's an anomaly, though?
Well, certainly it's not going to happen again. What you wonder about, though, we dropped by a dollar a gallon, again, $3.60 to $2.30, $1.30 a gallon in 1 year, and we go up by 80 traffic deaths per year. If our legislature decided to add tax to gasoline, not necessarily get it back up to 360, but at least to get it above 230, I think we reduce miles, we would save lives. Are we willing to do that? No. Our legislature has singularly failed to take measures that would increase revenue and save lives.
Right.
We've talked about increasing cigarette taxes. We could increase gas taxes. Either one of those would increase revenue and save lives, and we have been we will not do that. And I there it is. You've got 745 dead Kentuckians is what you got, you've got actually many more dead Kentuckians due to our cigarette related problems, and we will not take action. I'm a little frustrated, if you can't tell.
Okay.
This you look at these numbers and you see people strewn on the roadway. You see people's lives changed, and you wonder what could be if we took action.
When I put so many miles on my car, I wonder how many of those numbers I've witnessed. It's sad to say, but you know, I drive up and down I-64, you know, 120 miles a day, basically.
Yeah, there was a fatality last week.
Yeah, it's just awful. It's just awful.
All right, here's some good news. You want good news?
Good, let's finish up with the good news. Can we stretch this out long enough?
We'll see.
Do you have that club in your bag? Even though I don't know exactly, I'm not sure exactly when this was going to
happen. You're stalling right now.
Well, it's Masters Week, so I had to use a golf analogy.
Okay, right? Do I have this club in my bag? Because I did not get your golf analogy. I did not know what.
Well, you don't have that.
I thought
that
perhaps
shot.
I was supposed to have a backpack with a club in it I was going to beat you with.
You just don't have that wedge shot. You don't have an 8-degree driver off the pavement.
Kamel Khalili, who is the Laura Carnell Professor and Chair of the Department of Neuroscience, Director for the Center for Neurovirology, Director of the Comprehensive NeuroAids Center at the Lewis-Katz School of Medicine at Temple University. First of all, Kamel Khalili is a great name. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, but still, even mispronounced, it's a great name.
You lost me at comprehensive.
This is in the journal Nature, Scientific Reports, and he's talking about HIV infection. Now, remember, Rick, when we talked about the CRISPR-Cas9 system?
Okay, yeah.
All right, CRISPR-Cas9, just to remind our radio fans, scientists were astounded when they looked at the genome of bacteria. What they saw was a repeating segment, and in between this repeating segment, over and over again, were little bits of viral viral RNA. It looked almost like a trophy case of all the viruses that this particular bacterium had vanquished. And they saw that it was 20 years ago. They didn't know what it was for. As they learned more about it, they found that this, in fact, was not a trophy case, but it was a system whereby these little bits and pieces could attach to the virus if the bacteria ever saw it again. They attached it to something called Cas9, which is basically a DNA scissors. And the way we reported it was you have a pair of scissors with your name on it. If you're an invading virus, you have a pair of scissors with your name on it coming to snip you to bits. It is a terrifying, it is every virus's nightmare, if virus had nightmares. I guess they don't, but I don't know. All right, well, they also, this is Nobel Prize material because they also, they can snip genes. They can specifically make, attach this Cas9 to any type of RNA and go back and snip genes out of the genome. And so what they did at the Temple University, Lewis Katz School of Medicine at Temple University, Kamal Khalili, what he did and his group did was they attached it to the HIV genome. And so for cells that were infected with HIV, they went and snipped the HIV DNA out of the cell.
Wow.
So you can use medicines to stop the virus from replicating, but it still hides in the cell's DNA, and it still comes back and comes back and comes back, which is why we can't get rid of it. They snipped it out, and they found they were able to drop the levels dramatically. Now, it still doesn't completely clear it. This virus can hide a lot of places, but it does change the effectiveness. In effect, it deletes the HIV virus, which is extremely cool to me. Forget about antivirals and antibiotics. What if you just simply push delete with this CRISPR-Cas9 system?
It would be like the same as what's going to happen to this show in 8 seconds.
Right. And they actually looked to see if it caused any other bad effects on the genome. Could not find it in the laboratory. Question is, what happens to people? We don't know yet. What we do know is we got to get off the air.
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Hunter Reese and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or just visit us on Facebook. Do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is an injectable prescription WMKY inhibitor indicated as an addition to diet and statin therapy for the treatment of adults who require additional lowering of their bad cholesterol.
The effect of Health Matters on heart attacks and other heart problems such as stroke or death is not known. It is not known if Health Matters is safe and effective in children.
The most common side effects of Health Matters are reactions at the listening site, symptoms of the common cold, and influenza. The most common side effects leading to discontinuing our show were allergic reactions to Health Matters and elevated liver enzymes. Tell your doctor if you have any side effects that bothers you or does not go away.
Also, talk to your doctor about the right way to prepare and give yourself a Health Matters radio injection. But whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week on Morehead State Public Radio as we premiere the World Health Organization Knock Knock Joke Book. Knock Knock.
Who's there?
Dang it.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.